America's Webradio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
This is Michael Gineau with Insight to Israel, brought to you by America's Web Radio. And they tell me I don't have to say this all the time, but I want to because these guys are the best. Thank you to America's Web Radio for bringing the truth about the Jewish state, its greatness as it leads the world in technology, agriculture, medicine, and the vast amounts of humanitarian work that it does around the world, and its struggle for sovereignty and security. Thank you to the guys at America's Web Radio. You're the best. These guys came to me a year ago. We got a one-year anniversary coming up. Avi, can I call you Avi?
Sure.
Avi, one-year anniversary of Insight to Israel, Insight to Israel, that's correct. I apologize. And these guys called me up from Atlanta, Georgia, and they said, we want to know the truth about Israel. Mm-hmm. We'll give you the show. You come up with the name. Did you see the logo? Where's the business card?
Yeah, I got it.
Look at that logo. I came up with that logo. Look at that. Magen David right in the center.
Yeah, that's right.
Right in the center of the eye.
That's right.
Beautiful, isn't it?
You can't miss it.
I even got a t-shirt and a mug with a, it's like stands out. It's white and pure. This country's not perfect, but it is the apple of God's eye. Anyway, thank you to America's Web Radio and all the guys there. 1 year. Came here a year and a half ago, never would have thought. So you guys are the best, and I want to thank all the listeners, the emails that I get from friends, from family, from strangers on Facebook that say, great show. We learned a lot about Israel. I also want to say thank you to Americans, the patriot conservatives and the Christians, not the leftists. We got no use for them. Those that believe in the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, were born out of the heart of a righteous God as he moved on the hearts of men when they knew it not to form a country where in the eyes of God all men are created equal, that seek righteousness. And you folks have given to Hershey's for Heroes for almost a year now coming up. I started the program in June of last year. And if you don't know what Hershey's for Heroes is, if you've never participated, my, what you are missing out on. Americans are sending me thousands of chocolate bars with a note on each one thanking the soldiers for defending the Jewish state. And we love you, we pray for you, we stand with you. And I'll tell you, I get on all the bases here. I've got a picture with Benny Gantz. I don't know if you saw that, sir, on my Facebook page. I call him the Jewish John Wayne. Benny Gantz is the head of the military here. And these soldiers, you will never know what seeing that note on that chocolate bar means to these soldiers. It is a morale boost. I've literally had soldiers look at me, Avi, and say, Michael, the world hates us. Can you imagine being 19, 20 years old, and in your mind, in your heart, you're convinced the world hates you? That's a pretty sobering statement to make to a man who's never known hardship, who's never known turmoil or struggle in his life. And then I got a young person telling me at that age that the world hates you. America, you need to send me 1,000, 2,000, 5,000, 10,000 chocolate bars and show these soldiers that we will fight with them at all costs to defend every inch of this Jewish state because it is theirs. And this is not about land. This is about Jewish presence. So, America, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I love you guys. You're the best. Keep sending in those chocolate bars. Avi, I just had a church in Easley, South Carolina send me 500 chocolate bars. You know what? How my life has changed, sir. I'm going to introduce this gentleman I got sitting across from me. We're down here on the fine beaches of Tel Aviv, a beautiful day. And when I lived in the States, I'd go to my mailbox, and every time I'd get a bill, sure enough. I come to Israel, and what do I get? Chocolate. Fella can't beat that kind of life, you know? So, everyone, thank you for participating, for being a participator, not a spectator in Hershey's for Heroes. God bless you. Now, moving forward, It is another. I say it every morning, sir. I post it on my Facebook page. It's another beautiful day in the Jewish state. Avi, could you introduce yourself, please, sir, first and last name to the listeners?
Sure, sure. My name is Avi Goldwasser, and I live in the Boston area.
Currently?
Currently.
I want to get you back home, sir.
Well, it's too cold to go back, so I'm reluctantly going back, but it's great to be here. I come here often.
Thank you. Thank you for being on Insight.
Every day is a beautiful day here.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. You know, a friend of ours, a mutual friend of ours, Avi, introduced us about a week ago, and you put out a film. Now, you, from our conversation off air, you've made a few films. Is that, am I, was that the right impression?
Yeah, yes.
But you made a film here recently, and a lot of the listeners, I will tell you, that even if they're involved in politics, they don't know what J Street is. So this is going to be a good introduction. I didn't know what it was, I'll be honest with you, until I came here and I lived in Washington, D.C.
Right.
I didn't know what J Street was.
Right.
J Street, now we have K Street, which is all what your lobbyists
right.
in Washington, which are feeding this frenzy in D.C., but then we have J Street, which is a group of organizations.
Well, J Street is a take off from K Street, where K Street is where the lobbyists in Washington reside. They call themselves J Street to represent the Jewish lobby, so to speak.
The Jewish lobby?
Yeah.
Now,
but really what they were set up is to counter the APAC, the American Israel Political Action Committee,
yeah.
who they felt were right-wing and not representing sort of progressive Jews.
Progressive Jews.
The J Street is really a lobbying group for progressive Jews.
Now, I have to tell you, sir, that I actually was at and got invited to a little going-away party for a friend here in Tel Aviv. And I met this girl who just moved here who worked for APAC.
Mm-hmm.
And the minute she said she worked for APAC, my, those folks turn around and walk the other way. Now, I don't want to criticize APAC, but I don't know how right-wing they are. I haven't made that determination for myself. What I will say is that the Israelis that I talk to on a regular basis, in general, they feel as though, and I think this is what your movie displays from looking at it, there is a huge disconnect between the American Jews and the Israeli-born Jews whose children must fight in the military, who have suffered in the wars, who pay the taxes, you know, who have built this country out of bronze, brains, and Jewish blood. And, you know, we need you. That's why I'm having you on, because we need you to connect, bring that connection about. I watched your film, and I found it very interesting, because it spoke a lot of things. And I was very impressed by the way you did it, because it showed the hypocrisy of a call for peace, but yet there's never that give on the other side. But here's what I want to do. I want to start out by the listeners getting to know you. Where were you born and raised?
So, that's a good question. I was born in Poland.
Really?
But actually, I was born in the occupied territories of Poland.
Can I ask your age to start off? Because
yes,
that'll give us a time frame.
66.
Nice.
I was born in 1947.
Wow.
After the war. And as I said, it was the occupied territory. Now people say, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
Well, as a result of World War II, FDR agreed to give Russia the eastern part of Poland.
Right.
And in return, Poland got the eastern part of Germany. And literally, my parents, who were Polish refugees who survived the war in Russia, were shipped westward into formerly German territory. All the Germans were thrown out. They were ethnically cleansed. 8 million Germans were thrown from their homes in the Ukraine, in Russia, Czechoslovakia, and Poland.
Wow.
8 million
I didn't know
displaced
this.
People. And their houses, their properties were taken over by Ukrainians, Russians, Czechs, and Poles. And my parents, as refugees, their families destroyed, were sent to the what was known as the new territories for the Poles to populate. 8 million Germans were thrown out.
Wow.
And I was born in what was Germany only 2 years earlier.
Wow. What was that? And how old were your parents? Because they obviously came to Israel.
Yeah, they were young. They were in their 20s when I was born.
Nice.
And it was difficult because shortly after my parents returned after the war to Poland, they the communists took over.
Wow.
So it was not a pleasant situation for them, and they came to Israel. So they came to Israel in 1950.
Now, wow.
Right here.
Two years after Israel was declared a separate state. That's beautiful. Wow.
Yeah.
What that must have been like. Now, you say your parents were born in Russia.
No, my parents were born in Poland.
In Poland.
But survived the war by fleeing to Russia.
Wow. I can't imagine what that's like.
Well, many people fled. I mean, those who survived fled.
Right.
Those who stayed wound up in gas chambers.
Were they discriminated against in Russia because they were Jewish?
No, I think war was a terrible situation in Russia. Russia lost a lot of people.
Right.
Everybody was just trying to survive. And I think my parents were grateful that people shared bread with them and so on. It was a very tough situation.
Wow. I can't imagine.
A lot of suffering in war. They wound up in Central Asia. That's how they survived.
Wow.
Yeah. It's a long story.
I always find this stuff interesting. How did they get from there to here? Did they come by boat? Did they go by land?
How did they get from...
Because you were born...
How did they get to Israel?
Yeah.
Well, it's a long story, but from Poland, you can't leave a communist country. You can only run or escape. You
know,
like a jail. So they, I'm not sure the whole story, but they had to walk over the border to Czechoslovakia, then take a train, then a boat from Venice to Israel.
Wow.
It was a long journey.
You have to, for me, my mother talked to me one time and she said, "Michael, you say wow too much." I was like, sit here and talk to some of these folks.
Yeah.
You can't find words to describe because what do I know, sir? What do I know as an American?
There are a lot of people, many obviously, who survived the war and went through a similar journey to get out of Europe eventually. First of all, they come back to home. The home is destroyed.
Right.
There's no home. There's no future in Poland. They come to Israel or America. It's a long journey. It's not an uncommon immigrant story. So they came to Israel as immigrants, and 10 years later they came to America as immigrants. So
you were born and raised...
I was born in Poland.
Born in Poland.
I was
then
raised here.
Because I'm looking all around us. I wish the listeners, if you've looked at my Facebook page, the greatness. If I was an alien and they dropped me in the center of Israel, I would think this country was almost as big as the U.S. I take the bus everywhere, so when you stop at every stop, and take all the back roads, you think the country's so big, even though it's not really that big.
It's a tiny place.
It is very
tiny. We can drive to Damascus and come back the same day. Or Cairo. I mean, it's 10 hours, whatever.
Yeah.
It's a tiny place. You can't appreciate it. But I grew up in a very poor country. Israel was a very poor country in the 1950s.
But they say if you're poor, if you've never had it, don't know you're poor.
Exactly. I didn't feel I had a deprived childhood. Everybody was poor. We had no electricity, no cars.
And you're in Tel Aviv where it's hot, especially this summertime.
It was nothing here.
It's amazing what I'm looking at 65 years that the Jewish people have done. What was it like for you? I mean, I know you gave us, you were poor and everything like that, but what was it like school and dealing with the quote-unquote, the Arab Muslims?
Well, Israel was a small place, and I think it was a poor country in many ways, but it was a wonderful time for a child growing up. There was a tremendous unity. There was always the threat from the Arab countries. I was here in 56 when there was Suez War. My father went to the army, and my mother and my brother and I were sort of stuck, air shelters. You always live with tension. Let's put it this way. At the age of 5, I started listening to the news.
Really?
Because when the news comes on, everyone is silent.
Right.
Life depends on the news.
Right.
So I started listening to news at the age of 5, and I haven't stopped.
I'm a news freak. You know, I've talked to some parents in the States. I want to relate this. And they say, well, my son or daughter, they don't need to learn the Constitution, or, you know, my kids are too young to be in. They think it's all about politics. It's not. It's about knowing your history, knowing your past, and what your accomplishments are, what your failures are, so you can not make those same mistakes, but expound upon your accomplishments.
Exactly. The thing, in my opinion, the human condition hasn't changed. Human nature hasn't changed.
Right.
That's why we repeat the same mistakes, because
right.
we're fundamentally unchanged. And only if you study history do you realize the importance of understanding how people behave under different circumstances, and why there is no new age, there's no new man. We are the same as we've always been, facing the same problems. We just have tremendous technology, and we're certainly more aware. So anybody who denies the importance of history is bound to repeat it in an unpleasant way.
Right. So you grew up here. Now, you're a very smart man. I'll give you that. You come across that way. You pull it off.
Well, I studied engineering, so
okay.
That's my claim to fame.
Now, where did you go to when growing up? I mean, I know there's surfing here. I actually took a picture of surfers last summer, and people were like, surfing in Israel? Who knew? So what kind of things did you participate in?
As a child, all you do is play with your friends. I never saw... My parents never came to watch me play soccer or swim. I mean, you were on the streets growing up, and it was wonderful.
Wow.
It was wonderful. It was a great life for a kid. I loved it.
Yeah.
A great childhood.
And there's still that freedom today, especially when I go to places like Jerusalem, where I see packs of children with no adult accompaniment walking the streets. You cannot do that even in West Virginia.
It's the greatest place to raise kids.
Say it again.
It's the greatest place to raise kids.
Wow.
They're generally free. They go, they do things. It's wonderful.
Kids, I talked to parents in Nefrat in Judea.
Right.
Their kids go down to the Negev and go camping for the weekend.
Yeah,
you know, it's beautiful. It's something that helps remind me of my childhood when I had those days. So, and they're good kids. There's some really good kids here in this country.
Yeah, there's a spirit here, and there's a kind of attitude between people, and they love kids here. You just look around, especially young couples with kids. What especially strikes me is on Friday and Saturdays, you see men with young kids.
Yeah.
The women have a day off. All these fathers are pushing carriages, but there's tons of kids. Tons of kids everywhere.
And
it's great.
I tell new married couples, we need lots of Jewish babies.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So you went to college where?
So I went to college in CCNY, City College of New York, which is a very famous college in the city.
How did you get to New York?
CCNY. Well, my parents, my father's family was in New York. It was the only family he had. The rest were destroyed in Poland. So we had no family here, really. So my father eventually moved to the States. It was pretty hard life here. Let me give you how hard it was. We had food rations, and each family was allotted one egg per week per family. Okay, you know how much food there is today here. I mean, it's a rich, wonderful country.
Yeah.
But it wasn't always this way. It took a lot of hard work to get to where it is. So it was economically hard for my parents, and they moved to the States in New York, where they had family.
Was it a disappointment? How old were you when you left?
I was 12.
Was it a disappointment to you?
Very disappointing. I was quite happy here. I didn't have the economic hardship. I was just playing soccer and going to the beach. And I didn't need anything. I was fine.
Yeah.
So coming to New York was a big change.
Yeah. So what did your parents do as you grew up and came up in childhood? Like, what did your father do, your mother?
Well, it's like most immigrants to the States, they had to work very hard. It was all hard work. And, you know, I had to go to school, learn English, and look at most immigrants. There was no bilingual education. You sink or swim, you know, you just have to learn it. And you learn it because you have to.
Right.
So, New York City had a pretty good education system then, and think that it took a couple of years, but a lot of opportunities in America. And as an immigrant, you appreciate it and you recognize it. I remember going to the public library. It was unbelievable. Free books. Never heard of such a thing. Thanks, Carnegie. So it was great. And great schools. And City College was a free school. It was wonderful.
Wow.
You got a whole education for free.
Wow.
In New York. So it was a great, is a great country. It was a great country. I'm a big fan of America. I think America is the greatest country that ever existed and will ever exist.
Yeah, I agree. Thank God for it. I could have been born in a country of lesser estate.
Absolutely.
You know?
Absolutely. No, it's and I think immigrants tend to appreciate more.
Yeah.
I think you have to be elsewhere to appreciate America. You can't grow up there and appreciate it. It's just not human nature.
Right.
I like to take kids and drop them off in a third world country for 24 hours. So when they come back, they kiss the ground.
Right. No, you're absolutely
You can't appreciate it. You take everything for granted.
You're absolutely right.
So
you went to college and got your education as an engineer.
Yeah, I was an electrical engineer. Because that was sort of a safe path to economic, security.
Right.
Engineer.
Yeah. So what that transpired, and how long were you an engineer? Because that's very different.
Not too long, because I quickly learned that if you have an MBA, you can make more money.
Right.
I never heard of what an MBA is, but I quickly understood what more money is.
Right.
So I eventually got my MBA.
Nice.
So I shifted from engineering to business, and that was the right thing for me.
And what did you do in business?
I was in public accounting.
Okay.
Became CPA, and eventually I became financial controller. And
in New York City?
Executive. New York City, later in Boston.
Nice.
Yeah.
So you're
66.
And do you consider yourself retired at this stage of your life? Obviously not. Because
I don't believe in retirement.
There you go.
you got to do something. You got to have a purpose when you wake up.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You can only play golf so much or go fishing. No. So I've gotten involved in nonprofits, and that's really how I came to make films.
Now, I'm sure you would travel to Israel, in your adult life.
Yes.
You have a place here.
I don't have a place here. My daughter lives here.
Your daughter lives here.
My daughter lives here.
Okay. And so as you were coming up and your life progressed, how did you view Israel after having left as a child?
You know, I think I always liked being in Israel. There's a certain feeling as soon as you land. And I spend college summers in here and used to come almost every year. I think I got involved with Israel on a non-profit sort of basis when the Intifada, the second Intifada.
Now explain to the listeners what that is, because a lot of
So when the peace process failed in 1999-2000...
As it has many times in the past.
Yeah, the Palestinians launched a murderous attack on Jewish civilians through suicide bombings. It was awful. My daughter was living here, and every time there's something going on, she had to call me to tell me she's okay.
Yeah.
But it was nerve-wracking living in the States and waiting for the phone call every time a bomb went off.
Yeah.
And I have cousins here and so forth. It was a very tough time. But then the second thing that happened was my daughter was in grad school, and she was seeing what was going on college campuses, the hostility to Israel on U.S. college campuses.
Yeah.
And the third thing that happened was 9/11. So there was these three shocks, and I guess I decided at that point to get involved.
You know, what a lot of people don't realize is I've had some quote-unquote scholars here in Israel. I'm thinking of one right now. I won't say their name, but they do stuff for, they talk about UNRWA, United Nations, UNRWA, I think it's United Nations. Anyway, I remember when I first came, they were like, well, it's not the whole of the Arab world that hates Israel. I'm like, really? You don't think so? Let me clarify this. I want to follow that up by what you're talking about college campuses. People don't realize that there are two factions in Islam, Sunni and Shia, that fight each other for power. And then, like, the Saudis are funding the Muslim Student Union and all these other groups that have anti-apartheid week on these college campuses across the U.S. It's amazing how when we don't, what we don't see as far as funding comes from Muslim countries, you know, here in the Middle East and North Africa and Pakistan and in Iran, how they fund these, and then they, even in Europe, where Islam is taking a huge, strong foothold.
Yeah, so I think on campus, what you have first and foremost is radical leftist professors.
Yeah.
That's where it starts.
Yeah.
And they enable radical Muslim organization on campus.
Now, I'm not correcting my elders. I've read the Quran and studied the Hadith and the Sirah. These guys are doing exactly... To me, a suicide bomber from reading the Quran is not a radical or an extremist. He's doing exactly as it commands.
Yeah, I think on campus, just to separate the thing, I think on campus the problem is cultural Marxism, radical leftist professors who create the environment. And with the increase in Muslim students, you've got the combination of Muslim students organizations plus the radical professors engaged in an assault on Israel on campus and those who support Israel.
You know, it's something very interesting you say that, because a lot of these major universities, Yale and Harvard, which get a lot of funding from Saudi Arabia, and then they started out as Christian colleges by our founding fathers. That's the crazy thing about it.
Well, my theory is that you're right, that most university was set up as schools of theology, divinity schools.
Yeah.
And in fact, they're reverting back to being schools of divinity and no longer seek the truth. Except that now it's a different theology. It's a Marxist theology. But basically, they've abandoned the search for the truth in favor of political correctness and a political narrative. So that's just completing a circle where they started. But on campus, the hostility, again, you know, it's you don't want to exaggerate. There are 30,000 students in the big schools.
Right.
Only a few hundred people are involved in this radical activity.
But they seem to have a huge voice.
They do. They do, because very few people are willing to counter them. So if you study sciences, the hard sciences, engineering, it's wonderful. But if you go into humanities, it's a disaster. It's a total disaster.
Or the arts.
Any of the soft stuff.
Right.
Gender studies. So what happens is that these small group have a disproportionate voice. And most students just want to get the degree or have a good time and get a job.
Right.
But these people poison the university against Israel and against Jews.
Yeah.
And that's what we try to expose. I did a film called Columbia Unbecoming about Columbia University.
Yeah.
About what's going on there. But again, it's localized to a small part of the university. The problem is the administration is willing to tolerate this sort of anti-Semitism.
Right.
Partly because of the influence of Saudi money.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So it's not that they're bad, except that they're not going to deal with it if they don't have to, because they don't want to jeopardize funding.
That's it.
So there's an insidious impact to petrodollars flowing into American universities.
And especially with the tough economy in the United States, they'll take whatever they can get.
Well, the other problem is that they disproportionately invite foreign students who can pay full fare as opposed to giving scholarships to American students. So you've got a lot of negative dynamics there that hurt, I think, both America, Americans, and Israel.
Yeah. Sir, we're going to come right back. That is great stuff. I appreciate it. This is Michael Gannot with Insight to Israel. We'll be right back. This is Michael Gannot with Insight to Israel. Every day, the Israeli Defense Force finds itself on the front line of the war with the militant arm of Islam. Surrounded by enemies from within and without, they fight for the only Jewish state. Military service is mandatory, ladies serving 2 years and men serving 3 right out of high school. While young people in other democracies are busy traveling or attending university, Israeli men and women gear up for basic training. In a world of heads of state, politicians, ambassadors, diplomats, and a leftist media, many times our voice at the grassroots level is drowned out. So we started an ongoing project called Hershey's for Heroes. Patriot conservatives from all over the U.S. are sending Hershey's chocolate bars with a note of thanks for defending Israel. Won't you join us by sending a sweet message to the IDF? For information, please see my Facebook page at Michael Gonneau. Thank you, God bless Patriot conservatives, and God bless Israel in her struggle for sovereignty and security. And we're back. This is Michael Gonneau with Insight to Israel. Wow, wow, wow. A lot of great stuff. Avi, I'm glad we're on the same team, sir. I'm glad we're on the same team. It is a beautiful evening out here. I'm looking out on the water. See that yacht out on the water? Look at that.
Yeah.
The water's placid. It's calm. There are tables here on the beach. Folks sitting enjoying a coffee. Their kids playing. You couldn't ask for anything better, sir.
It's a beautiful, peaceful scene.
It's amazing. I wake up every morning, Avi. I go to my window and I say, God, thank you for another day in the Jewish state.
And just the diversity of people and the languages.
It is. It's
amazing. Looking at a guy from Ethiopia, a guy from Sudan, a guy from Russia, a guy from France.
It's beautiful. Beautiful. And, you know, even you find yourself, you know, we're not that far from Jaffa, where there's a lot of Muslims that live.
A lot of Arabs, sure.
A lot, and you find them meandering down in this part and having a coffee.
Absolutely.
There's no, let me, for all those who are listening that the media says this is an apartheid state, there's no separate bathrooms, there's no separate drinking fountains. They have the same equal rights and even more than even the Jewish citizens here. And I say that with regard to the fact, I just talked to some soldiers before you and I met. And these soldiers, I told them, I said, you defend this country. And there are Arabs in the military. I don't want to discount that. And I'm thankful for their service. I'm making a point. But it's like 0.01% compared to the Jewish children that know they must defend this country. And it's their commitment to their homeland. To me, sir, they win my heart every day when I say thank you.
Yeah, I basically do not spend much time defending Israel because Israel is one of the most wonderful countries in the world.
I agree.
It's by far the best country in the Middle East.
Absolutely.
And to have people lie, accuse Israel and Jews of blood libel, it's so obscene. I'm not going to waste my time even discussing it.
Right.
To call this an apartheid state, just go to any Arab country, and then you tell me this is an apartheid state.
Right.
It's an insult to the blacks in South Africa who suffered under apartheid.
Right.
To call this an apartheid state.
Yeah.
This is heaven. Any Arab who lives in Israel is so much better off to be in Syria or Egypt or Lebanon or most places around here.
Right.
Nothing is perfect, nothing is exactly equal.
Absolutely.
But I'm sure if you gave Arabs a choice whether they want to live under Israeli hegemony or Syrian hegemony or Iranian hegemony or Hezbollah hegemony, I'm sure that they prefer to be right here.
Yeah.
And it's all because of Israeli hegemony that all these people don't kill each other like
right.
they do in every almost every country around here.
Absolutely. That's a very valid point,
but
sir.
Israel's not perfect for sure.
Right.
It's just better than most countries in the world.
Right. No, I agree. And I'll tell you, look, I've been here for a year and a half, almost 2 years. And I will say that it's not always been easy to be away from my family. I miss them. I love them. But the work that I do here, I'm thankful for it because, number one, because I feel a strong conviction about the Jewish state and I believe in its sovereignty and security. The other thing is, on a side note, it just so happens I found a good niche. As someone who's not Jewish that tells this story, it gives me an edge. And I'm very happy to tell it. I find joy. And the people here, I will tell you, they're some of the best. They have treated me and embraced me as one of their own. And, you know, we're celebrating Purim right now.
I don't see your costume. You could have had a hat or something.
Someone asked me today, they said, where's your costume? I said, I'm a Mossad agent. You just don't know it.
You're undercover.
Exactly. But I you know, even right now, like, look at this right here. We have this dad walking this child, and, you know, it's beautiful. And there's a security I feel here, and I see the children have, that blesses me every day. So, anyway, listen, you have, just from the first segment, your life has been, and your family's history, to me, as someone who's never even experienced, I'm 43, what do I know? But I look at other people's lives, and I say one of two things: God, that could be me, and maybe those hardships would have been good for me, but I'm glad that I can learn from other people and not necessarily have to go through them.
That's right.
But to take in what you experienced, make it my own, and go with it and learn something. And I'm thankful for my elders, for those who have paved the way. You know, I'm thankful for that. So you find yourself in Boston?
Boston, yes.
Boston. And you do advocacy work as a voice for the Jewish people.
Well, what I've done is do advocacy for Israel on college campuses.
Very, very important.
Yeah, but along the process, I discovered filmmaking, which I've never done before, never thought about. But actually, if I may,
please.
I spent a lot of time on college campuses where Israel is being accused of everything. Of all the countries in the world, Israel is the one always on trial, always having to defend itself. And there are a lot of misconceptions about Israel. And the biggest one I noticed on campus was that people believe that the Jews in Israel came from Europe. So I did a film to show that half of the Israelis are Jews who came from Egypt, from Iraq, from Yemen, from North Africa, from Syria, from Lebanon. They were indigenous to the Middle East. They were here before the Muslims came, before the Arabs came.
Right.
And the film was called The Forgotten Refugees. Everyone knows about the Palestinian refugees. No one knows there were even more Jewish refugees who lost their property, lost their communities in Libya and in Cairo and in Iraq and Baghdad.
Speaking of which, let me ask you this. I think we should clarify something for the listeners, because there's a huge misconception about the word Palestinian. And it's probably said 1,001 times, but it should be cleared up 1,002. But the word Palestine, if I understand correctly, studying my history, derived from the Romans, who used that term, came up with that term, from one of Israel's greatest enemies, the Philistines. And they wanted to wipe out the entire existence, which countries at that time did when they conquered a people. They wanted to wipe out their entire existence, language, everything. And so that was the objective of the Romans by coming up with that term.
And that's right. This was known as Judea in the Roman Empire. But after the rebellion, the Romans were quite annoyed. And as an empire, you don't stand for anybody rebellion.
Right.
And to teach the Jews the lessons, besides exiling them, they changed the name to Palestine. And in fact, the irony is that the Jews who lived here before the state of Israel were called Palestinians. They were Arabs and Palestinians, and the Palestinians were the Jews.
Even though there was no Palestinian government ever, there was
no coin, no money. 500 years of Turkish Ottoman rule here.
Right. And before that was there were the Crusaders, and before that there was. It's the Romans and then the Crusaders.
There were so many different empires going through here. For anybody to not understand that this land, because it's a passage from Asia to Africa,
there you go.
It's always been contentious. The Via Maris, the
and can I add to that, sir? Yeah. We had a discussion again off air. I have a lot of Israelis, especially here in Tel Aviv, that ask me, why are we so persecuted? Is it because we're so smart, or people are jealous? my answer is always this. You can deny God, but the fact remains is that God chose this land. The feet of Abraham carved it out. And God chose the Jewish people to be a representation of who He was and His love and mercy and kindness when we obey, and judgment when we disobey. And so, with that being said, mankind in his wickedness does not like, want God or his laws, because it comes, there comes about, not just in this life, but in the afterlife. I don't want to, I'm going to make my point. Especially in the afterlife, we don't like the fact that we have to be accountable for our actions, for our ungodliness, our wickedness, our evilness. So they want to do away with God. So in their finite thinking, they think if they do away with God's representation, they will do away with an infinite God. And the same goes, whether people agree or not, with Christians, because we see the in history, the only two persecuted people in the world, mainly, are Christians and Jews. We're so very interconnected. Islam's a side issue. They hijacked a lot from us. But my point is that when you look at this land, sir, I get excited when I think about this. When you look at this land that has never always been occupied, but never a real governance that's been set up or established. It's always been, whether it was a government or a monetary system, it was always brought from the outside and put on here in the land, but never anything really established. And you, like you said, it's a very good point that it's been that moving point between one part of the world and another. And I find it very fascinating that in spite of the fact that so many people have moved through here and occupied it for various reasons, that they were never settled or even called it their own. Does that make sense what I'm saying?
Yeah, well, there's a long history, and there's recorded history and before that. But I think fundamentally this land has been, in the last certainly 2,000 years, occupied by a variety of empires.
With always Jewish presence.
Indigenous. Yeah, the Jewish presence, there was always a Jewish presence here. But it's a complex history, and it's fascinating, obviously.
It is.
Walk this land, and you know the stories, and there's so many stories. I think fundamentally there is a misunderstanding of Israel, because the Zionist narrative has been replaced with a Palestinian narrative. And that's because the Palestinians and the Arabs have poured an enormous amount of money into propaganda.
Right.
While the Israelis are not too clever when it comes to marketing and propaganda.
Can I say, you know what, I'm glad you said that, because I hear this from a lot of soldiers.
Yeah.
I disagree with that, sir. I strongly disagree. I'll tell you why. Because I've worked in media and in politics for many years, most of my life, and I think you do a fine job. I think the problem is the world refuses to listen. And I'm not trying to contradict you. I'm saying that they refuse to listen. I've seen what you guys do, and I think it shows the media that you put out. And especially with the facts, it's not just propaganda in itself. The fact is, when you look at all the humanitarian work you do around the world, it's beautiful. It's amazing.
You think people care or the good work? You think goodness is recognized and appreciated?
No, that's what I'm saying.
Okay, so that's the problem. My point is, and I'll just go back to the film I made called The Forgotten Jews, that people don't know about the displaced Jews, the destruction of Jewish communities around the Middle East. They just don't know, because we failed to tell the story.
Okay.
Anyway, so I don't mean to sort of promote the film, but I think it's an important film that even the Israelis don't know the full story.
Now, tell us the name of it again.
The Forgotten Refugees.
The Forgotten Refugees. Where can we find that?
Just Google it. It's on the web.
Forgotten Refugees. I think Americans need to do that.
They need to see it. I've shown the film in another country. I showed it in Israel. People were shocked because they said, gee, I read the New York Times, I watch CNN, I listen to NPR, I never heard a single Jewish refugee. There's 900,000 of them, and they've never been written up. I got to tell you that for the first time I can remember, The Economist magazine finally had an article about Jewish refugees.
Wow.
It was like the past month. It's one of those unknown stories. The UN has 190 resolutions about refugees. Not one of them deals with Jewish or Christian refugees from the Middle East.
Right. Right.
So we have failed to communicate.
You know, with that being said, I think that there's more Jewish refugees in the United States that are comfortable living in their life, enjoying, while folks here are fighting for sovereignty and security. I personally, and I don't agree with the diaspora. I think it's time for all the Jews to come home after 2,000 years of exile. And I would consider them, me personally, would consider them refugees, but that's not the point in our discussion.
No, but, you know, I think people need to decide where they want to live and who they want to be. So
right.
I'm not here to judge someone. I would just say that there's a reason why there are 6 million Jews in America and not in Russia or China or South America. And it's the greatness of America that permits, that attracted those Jews to come to America and not to go elsewhere.
Right. I think the United States was the intent in the big picture of it was especially in its founding, when you looked at the way the world was, it was a place as a refuge.
Exactly. For a lot of people.
Yeah.
A lot of people.
Yeah.
And that makes America unique in the world. Even today, if you ask most people in the world, where would they like to immigrate to? There's nothing like America.
Yeah.
There's nothing like America.
I agree. Now, let's talk about this J Street.
Yes. Yes.
I saw a little bit of your film. I saw the advertisement for it on YouTube.
Yeah.
And it was very well done. And it showed the injustice of the media and government entities that bring a great deal of oppression to Israel, unjustified. What made you want to do...
So...
because there's a lot of people on J Street, I'm sure they're not too keen on hearing... Opposition.
Yeah, I think if you look at the world today, as you know, Michael, Israel is under assault from a lot of different sides. And we know that. But J Street represents an assault within the Jewish community against Israel, which is a little unusual.
It happens here in Israel.
It happens too, and it's the same. J Street are really the people who tried to sell that pacifist concept here and failed because the Israelis were bitten by reality, mugged by reality with the Intifada. And then they took it to America to try to circumvent Israeli democracy by getting the U.S. government to force Israel to do what its elected officials didn't want to do.
Yeah.
That's the insidious thing about J Street. They're trying to do an end around Israeli democracy.
You know, that's what confuses a lot of Americans that are pro-Israel. And a lot of those Americans are in the Christian community. And you have a lot of support, regardless of what our government does. In fact, I found that there are Christians that are smart enough, seeing the direction that the U.S. government is going, as it proves through its policies, and especially this administration, talk is one thing, but policy is another, that they are not so pro-Israel, and there are Americans that would come here and fight for this country, and to preserve it.
Yeah, so I think the problem that the film deals with is a political problem. And what fascinated me is, why would Jews turn against Israel? Now, they don't say that's what they're doing because they claim to be pro-Israel.
Right.
So that was a puzzle. They said they're pro-Israel, but some of the things they do don't appear to be pro-Israel. So what's the story here? And the purpose of the film was to understand J Street's position, what the goals are, and how they're doing, the tactics. And their stated goal is the creation of a Palestinian state. And in an Orwellian sense, they say to be pro-Israel means just to be pro-Palestinian. I can't exactly explain that. So the film tries to understand why this group attracted a lot of young idealistic Jews. What's going on here? because they failed to do this in Israel. The peace movement in Israel suffered severe setbacks after the Intifada, and obviously in the recent election they can't get too many votes.
Yeah.
The Labor Party is really sort of collapsed from its heyday. So these people who were in Israel, J Street founders were in Israel in the 90s, and they failed to convince the Israeli electorate to follow with the peace process. So they came to America and were selling the same concept to American Jews to pressure Israel to do what the Israelis didn't want to do.
What I can't understand about that is, now to me, I'm going to tell you, sir, I don't have to hold anything back. And sometimes I want the opposition to knock on my door, because I'm the kind of guy that when I see what these young people go through, what the people in this country go through, I say burn the negotiating table and drive it straight through the heart. Drive the leg of that table straight through the heart of your enemies, because they're not going to care anyway. My point is that I can't comprehend that yet. To me, yeah, you have to be pretty wicked to see your own people murdered, killed by suicide bombers. Your way of thinking, your ideology has failed. So then you take it to the United States and still try to promote it.
Okay, because, and let's give him the benefit of the doubt for a
second. That's kind of hard.
Because
you're a better man than I am, obviously.
They fundamentally believe that people are good. The conflict is a matter of misunderstanding. And if we show generosity and kindness to them, they will reciprocate. It's a kind of idealistic, maybe delusional notion, but I think there are many true believers who believe that we can achieve it through this generosity by offering them more land or whatever they want.
You're only so big, though. I mean,
it's a joke. I mean, we're so tiny. We're less than 0.5% of the area of the Middle East. So it's not about land. It cannot be about land.
It's not.
No, it's not land. So to think, and this is the JC position, that just because we create a Palestinian state, suddenly peace will break out, to me is delusional.
Right.
To me is delusional.
Right.
Now, I don't question their motives in being sincere and delusional, but many of them are young idealists who can't stand the conflict, who want to see some resolution.
Right.
People are tired of it. I understand.
I know, I agree. I talk to Israelis all the time.
And part of the problem is that they also feel that Israel taints them, because Israel has to take some tough actions. When 60 rockets are launched from Gaza,
I was down in Sderot.
You have to do something.
Yeah.
And whatever you do, it's not going to be pleasant. There'll be innocent who will suffer.
That's life.
The way, right. But they cannot accept.
Wow, I just can't fathom being that stupid and that deluded.
Ah, okay, but that's the point of the film.
Right.
To understand what are they thinking.
Yeah.
And many of them I call true believers. They really believe that if we only did a little bit more, it'll solve the problem.
And the funny thing is, it's easy for them to say, because they're over in the States now.
Exactly. So now you get into the next layer. Who are you to decide for someone else what risks they ought to take?
Right, right.
That's pretty irresponsible. It's pretty responsible.
Yeah.
So there's a kind of strange sort of thinking on their part, and you wonder, and they come up with all sorts of excuses why they have a right to tell the Israelis what to do with their lives, what risks to take for peace.
Right.
Which is nonsense. It's imperialistic.
Yeah.
If any country tells another country what to do, we used to call it imperialism. So this is sort of tough love, or they come up with all sorts of descriptions, which is really what the film is about.
So you show this film. Now, you've said you've shown it here in Israel.
The film premiered in Miami Beach on February 17th, recently.
Where did you actually in Miami show it?
We rented a theater. We got 400 people. We sold out within 2 days.
Wow.
Yes. So I asked myself, I didn't expect it, but why would somebody be so excited about a film they haven't seen, except for a two-minute trailer? And I think what we're discovering, based on the reaction, is that people are pretty angry at J-Street.
They suspect
deception. They suspect a kind of betrayal. They suspect a kind of unfairness of people living in comfort in Washington, D.C., or Bel Air, California, Los Angeles, Beverly Hills, New York City, telling people here who every day have to deal with potential rockets from Gaza, some suicide bomber, and ultimately the threat of nuclear war from Iran. They're telling them what to do, what risk to take. It's outrageous.
Yeah.
And that anger, I think, is manifested in the response we got just by announcing a film.
Yeah.
People say, I want to see it. I want to bring it to my community. And we've had over 50 requests for screenings around the country.
Wow.
And we have scheduled dozens of screenings. And the way we do it is we want to mobilize the community. We don't want to sell DVDs.
Right.
We don't want you to watch it on a little screen or on your TV screen.
Right.
I want you to come out, meet some other folks, and let's talk about what's the proper relationship between the American Jewish community and Israel.
Right.
What rights do we have to tell them how to live their life?
Right.
Okay, and what's the real situation here?
Yeah.
And why are people promising all sorts of utopias just because you give them more land?
Right.
As if that's going to make a difference.
No, because they, first of all, you know, the Palestinians, Mahmoud Abbas, or in Hebrew, Abu Mazen, has said that he won't even recognize the Jewish state. And then John Kerry comes along and says, well, what right do you have? The Jewish state was recognized in 1948. What right do you have to demand of these people to recognize you? As far as when I say, I don't use the word Palestinian, I use the word Muslim. Because the same problem you guys have, the rest of the world is having. But,
so here's the way, I mean, we, by the way, try not to get into the Middle East conflict in the film.
Okay.
That's very complicated. We're just focusing on one organization that claims to have a solution to something that for 100 years nobody's been solved, and they have a solution. As if peace is a matter of a piece of paper. Okay, so that's the focus of FEMA. I mean, I don't claim to know what the answer is to the conflict. It's very complex. It's very sad.
I don't think it's so complex. I really don't.
Well,
I mean, anyway.
It depends what you mean by complex. But, so the point is much more about this group of people who are trying to influence the American Jewish community in a manner that I think is dishonest.
Very dishonest.
And in a manner that involves significant marketing and PR, very clever PR programs. It's like selling soap or selling any product. They're very good at it. And that's what caused us to make the film. We wanted to counter this high intensity sales pitch, which to me is like snake oil, because the message that they're selling is not substantiated by the facts, and the other side needs to be presented, and the community should engage in discussion and not just accept the one side of view that J Street tries to impose on the community.
Now, if a church, let's say a church in West Virginia, wanted to see this movie, how do we get this out? Because not just to the Jewish community, but to people who really love Israel and support Israel.
Well, we have a whole Christian outreach.
What's that?
We're working with Christian groups to screen the film. It's very easy. Anybody who wants to screen the film, they go to the website, they send me an email.
And the website
and
is?
We will have the jstreetchallenge.com.
And we're going to post that up.
Yeah, and there's a, if you want to do a screening, there's a page on the website and you fill the information, and we'll help you facilitate a screening.
Nice.
No problem.
Nice.
So we want as many people as possible to see the film. We're a non-profit organization. It's all about getting the message out. We're not trying to...
Absolutely.
You can't make money on these documentaries anyway.
Yeah. Listen, I know what you're talking about when it comes to non-profit.
There's a reason they call non-profits.
Yeah. So how much longer do you see... I mean, you're going to stay in this fight for the sovereignty and security of Israel.
Look,
there's nobody's ever retired like this.
There's no solutions. There's no end. It's just managing problems to different degrees.
Right.
Unfortunately, Israel is being attacked from a variety of sources. And one of them is what I call the progressive Jewish element.
Right.
And their problem. And they make it difficult for us to deal with people who really want to destroy the Jewish state.
Yeah.
And I think they need to be exposed, and they need to be engaged in discussions. We welcome them, by the way, to come to the screenings that we have.
Yeah.
They're afraid. They refuse.
Yeah.
They accept, and then they back out. We challenge them. Come, let's talk about it. If you disagree with the film, I'll give you a platform.
Absolutely.
Come discuss it.
Absolutely.
We're eager to talk to you about it.
Sir, we're going to post all your information. I'm very thankful for a man like yourself that is willing to give of his time and not retire. When you,
well, I'm doing it for my grandchildren.
Absolutely.
And I appreciate being invited on your show, and I appreciate the time you spend with me.
Yeah.
Very grateful for the opportunity to tell the folks what we're doing and why.
And we're going
to
have you on again, Avi, because we want to know, we want to see continued results and report those results to the American people who stand with Israel.
Great. Appreciate it.
Sir, God bless you.
Thank you.
God bless the United States of America, the patriot conservatives who stand with the Jewish state. And God bless Israel in her fight for sovereignty and security.